Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm going to cover just a little bit on the Pure HVAC technologies and then turn it over to Corey for the lighting. There are three central technologies that are pretty much no-brainers, and those are the variable speed kitchen ventilation technology. We, 2 years ago at the conference, demonstrated one of those at the Covell Dining Hall where we're eating, saving 54% of the energy, as I recall. Virtually all of them save 50% of the fan horsepower, and depending on the weather conditions, 10 to 25% of the HVAC. So we are convinced those are really something every kitchen should look at. If they're not on your list, please put them on. Save with Insight and DART are two different technologies for variable air volume systems. The first one, Save with Insight, basically takes an existing variable air volume system and replaces the measurement and control tool and algorithm. So they put in an airflow station and use the airflow coming out of the fan, not the static air pressure of the duct, and a different control algorithm that basically improves the efficiency and saves somewhere around 15 to 35% in our test. DART is a retrofit of a dual duct system, and we have an example of both of these at UC Santa Barbara here, that retrofits the temperature sensors in the different zones with a wireless temperature sensor, and then converts the fans into variable speed fans and controls, and they're once again saving somewhere in the range of half of the 35 to 50% of the fan horsepower and a significant amount of the HVAC. So these things are very proven technologies. If they're not in your portfolio list of things that they're looking at, I highly recommend that you do. So basically kind of went through most of this. The expected savings, you know, once again, are 50%. If you have five dining halls, for instance, it's about 245,000, a quarter million kilowatt hours a year, and, you know, less than a three-year payback. So these things really are, if you did the entire system, it's quite a significant amount of energy. The DART system I basically covered. Federspiel Controls is a controls manufacturer. They can see more information at our booth than the peer booth. It's a peer-developed product. This is the operating data from Cheadle Hall where we put the DART system in, where it was saving 58% of the energy. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Corey Jackson to talk about the lighting solutions, sort of nicknaming the 50% solutions, really emphasizing putting in the deep energy savings that are saving the state of the art, 50 to 70%, not your typical retrofit savings that only save 20, 30%, because we're really concerned about the lost opportunity of us trapping that lower and poorer solution for the next decade. And with that, I'll introduce Corey Jackson, who's a research engineer at the CLTC and also the key person helping manage the field work and on our demonstration projects on the lighting side, and has done a wonderful job. And I think I look at the audience and I'd say probably 10% of you have met and talked to Corey already. So, Corey.
See if I can figure out the clicker as an engineer. Okay. Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. As Carl said, my name is Corey Jackson. I'm a research engineer at CLTC up at UC Davis. And we got together, the peer program and CLTC, back in January to plan a series of demonstrations for UCSB, lighting demonstrations, to help them decide if any of these technologies would be a good fit for them to move forward with on their drive to go towards net zero. So I'm going to talk about some of the projects that we did here on campus and the savings that we expect to achieve during those. And then if anyone has any questions for me, we'll talk about that at the end. So the five groups of technologies that I'm going to talk about are bi-level smart exterior lighting, which if any of you visited the best practices this morning, we touched on that. So We'll look at that. We'll look at wireless controls for retrofit applications. We've taken the bi-level exterior product line and moved it a step forward and added some wireless controls so that we essentially have on, off, and high and low. We'll look at integrated office lighting systems that we did for the recreation center. And we'll look at interior lighting controls that were coupled with those demonstrations and some interior LED lighting that we tried over at Carrillo. Bi-level smart exterior lighting. Essentially, we're taking a source that is dimmable with an instant on-off characteristic and adding occupancy-based controls so that the lights can be brought down to about 50% during unoccupied times of the night, and then instantaneously we'll switch up the full light output based on occupancy. So the two technologies that we worked with here at the parking garage over Mesa Garage on the corner of Mesa and Ocean, we looked at an induction technology and an LED technology deck-mounted fixture. I don't know if anyone's been over to that garage, but the lights are on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Even the top deck is on, and it has good exposure to sunlight. So we really wanted to capture both the bi-level for nighttime savings, but to get them some daytime savings with the addition of photo controls. Currently, aside from Santa Barbara, we have demonstrations at Sacramento State University of the LED product, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, who spoke this morning about their demonstration program. And then we have a campus-wide retrofit at UC Davis that they're moving forward with this initiative. So we're very excited, and all this stemmed from original demonstrations that came out of the peer program. The first luminaire that I want to talk about is a bi-level induction luminaire. It's a deck-mounted luminaire. Out of the box from the manufacturer, it did not come with any daylighting, so the next thing we'll talk about is the daylighting that was added. But this is essentially a 80-watt induction fixture that we replaced 150-watt high-pressure sodium. We have the same amount of light and distribution on the deck floor, so we're really happy about that. We added wireless relays into each of these fixtures that communicate to a single photocell on the garage, so we were able to extinguish the luminaires during the day along the perimeter where we were demonstrating. And because of security and safety issues, the interior of the garage, the facility did not want to extinguish those, and the way the garage was circuited, if we would have just controlled the entire circuit with a traditional photocell, it wouldn't have been appropriate to turn off the lights inside just to get the savings on the perimeter. So we added the wireless controls as a second-tier layer. That product came out of the peer demonstration, the peer development program, and is now in demonstration. So they work with photocells, occupancy sensors, essentially any lighting load that you need to work with. The induction lamps, as I said, were selected because they have a very, very long life, so they reduce maintenance costs, and they're an instant restrike, instant on-off technology. So when we're switching for occupancy or switching for daylighting, there's not the warm-up time that's typically associated with your metal halide or your high-pressure sodium. And again, these are over at Lot 18. They're on the second floor along the eastern perimeter, if anyone goes by there and wants to check them out. And we expect about 58% savings from just the fixture itself, not including the daylighting. So the combination of the demand reduction from high-pressure sodium to induction coupled with the occupancy sensing should be about 58%. The second technology that we put in over at Mesa, one floor above the induction, was an LED fixture. That's the same fixture that Sacramento State University did in one of their parking garages, the same technology that's over at the Mondavi Center at UC Davis. So this is a deck-mounted fixture. It has fixture-integrated occupancy and photo controls in each fixture, so there was no need to add the wireless controls after the fact for that. With LEDs, you can drive them at different currents, and so you'll get a variable light output based on the drive current. The fixture that we selected here is doing about 115 watts in high and 35 watts in low, and there's different combinations you can select for your facility, so it's nice to be able to do that. Actually, the ones we have in right now are going on-off, which was a mistake on my part, but in the end, they'll go to high-low, and they'll be 35 and 115. So right now, if you go over there during the night, you'll see an on-off switching based on occupancy. So And with those, we expect about a 51% savings compared to the existing high-pressure sodium. Do I have?
Payback time.
We did not look at payback in these slides. I can give that to you after the fact. I think we have it back at the booth. And we'll talk. So the third technology that we looked at was a bi-level fluorescent. And gentleman just asked about payback. The fluorescent is a very cost-effective technology, and we found that that was missing in the portfolio with the induction and LEDs, which can be a much more expensive. So we came in after the fact, after the development effort was done with induction and LED, and added on just a low-cost fluorescent retrofit for facilities that really have cost in mind. And it essentially does the same thing. There's a bi-level ballast integrated into it, an occupancy sensor mounted on the side of the fixture, and it switches from two lamps down to one, T8 lamps. It's available in a variety of fixture lengths and styles. This is out of the Daybright line of products, is their VaporLoom series. So we're really excited about this one. I think it'll get a lot of traction just because of the price point. But at the savings at UCSB, we went from two T8s to another two T8 system, but because of occupancy in the garage where we installed it, it's over at lot 22, we expect about 35% savings from that technology. We did do one demonstration with a traditional lamp, which is a metal halide source. We did a perimeter wall pack over behind Carrillo, and it's a little more difficult to work with the traditional sources because of the restrike and warm-up times. But we went ahead and we're trying this out. There's three wall packs in the loading area, and we replaced a 150-watt lamp with another 150-watt lamp, added occupancy sensors to it so that it's going down by half during the night. And this facility is essentially empty most of the evening, so they're able to capture a pretty big savings there, 25%, even with no reduction in demand. And this is offered as well through Daybright. I talked a little bit about this with the induction fixtures. The technology that we used as the aftermarket is a development project that came out of a program from the Energy Commission called Lighting California's Future. And this technology, a wireless interface for photosensors and motion sensors, or YPAM, is designed to work as an out-of-the-box solution with existing photocells and motion sensors. So this company is not making those sensors. You can get those anywhere. They're making the interface that will communicate wirelessly to the fixtures. So we expect, of course, 50% savings by adding this, because during the day, those fixtures will be completely extinguished. The second sort of group of technologies that we did over at the rec center, for them, they had limited lighting, interior lighting controls. So we wanted to demonstrate for them a suite of controls that they could use to capture occupancy and daylighting in some of their teaching facilities and classrooms and gymnasiums. We ended up doing a suite of controls over at their ceramics room, which is a combination of simplified daylight harvesting. It's a photosensor technology that was developed at CLTC as part of the PEER program. The problem with photosensors is they're often difficult to commission, and they require recommissioning as space changes and lighting levels, reflectances and things in the room change. This is a self-commissioning photosensor, so in theory, once it's installed, we hope you won't have to come back and play with it anymore. We're going to investigate that as this demonstration goes on. But the big benefit is the self and auto commissioning aspect of the sensor. We installed it in a suite, so to speak, of controls with occupancy sensing and then a low voltage toggle override so that they could turn the daylighting off or turn the electric lights on if they needed, even though there was sufficient daylight. So that suite of technologies over at the rec center, we expect about 50% savings from that demonstration. And all of these products, I don't know if it's, they're all offered through the Watt Stopper currently. We expect more licensing agreements for the simplified daylight harvesting. It's available. LED lighting is making a big push in the exterior. The interior is getting a little harder sell, I've found, with some of the campuses. And so we wanted to look at LED lighting in a variety of applications for the campus so they could see sort of the state of the art and decide if it was something that they wanted to move forward with or not. As part of the integrated office lighting system, which is the next slide, we have the personal lighting system, which is an LED task light system developed by FineLight in the upper right-hand corner there of the screen. And then we have LR24 architectural panels, which is an LED panel replacement for like a recessed fluorescent troffer. It's a 2x2 panel. We've done that in an office over at Carrillo. And then there's also LED downlights. One of the major development projects to come out of Lighting California's Future, which is that program with the Energy Commission, was the Halo LED downlight. It was the first Energy Star rated LED downlight to come onto market, and that's through Cooper Lighting. And you'll see it down here in the corner. Right there, it's you'll see the bare LED, the source in the middle. There's available trims and fixture lensing options to sort of help with the glare issue of that direct source. And we have a second LED downlight product that's going to come out of Lighting California's Future, which is an indirect downlight, an indirect direct downlight. Essentially, there'll be a piece, crosshairs on the downlight that direct the light first up to the top of the can, and then it'll reflect back down, and that will eliminate the glare. And we hope to have that product out to market in the next 6 months, so we're really excited about that. As I said, the Cooper product is the first Energy Star rated downlight. It's dimmable down to 15% on a standard analog dimmer, so there's no need to install, you know, special digital dimmers to work with this product. That was one of the goals, was to make it dimmable on standard analog dimmers. It's on the market now. The installation where we have it at Carrillo, we expect to save about 80% on that fixture. We replaced a two fluorescent troffer, 232-watt T8s, with a single downlight, only because that troffer was only used for safety lighting above the door, and there was really no need to have that large of a fixture for the egress lighting on the emergency circuit. So we replaced it with a single one of these downlights. This was the LED product I spoke of that's not quite yet on the market, but you can see the crosshairs there in the picture. You don't actually see the LED source like you do with the Halo product. It's the light's directed back up into the can, and so it really eliminates the glare issue that's associated with LEDs typically. At the rec center, they were still using T12s. Can you imagine? T12s. But so we saw it as a really great opportunity to do some office lighting retrofits, something that's very simple that I'm sure many of the campuses are doing on their own, which is just a simple lamp and ballast retrofit. What we did, though, was couple it with some LED task lighting, which gave them increased lighting at the work surface, so we were able to use a very low ballast factor in the T8 conversion. And really cut their ambient lighting costs by about half by adding the task lighting on the desk. So it really worked out great. And then in addition, we added some occupancy sensing. They had no controls what to speak of in these offices. So with the addition of wall-based occupancy sensors and ambient lighting change and the LED task lighting, we netted about 70% energy savings for the facility. So in conclusion, you know, lighting is a really, really simple and easy thing, often looked at as the first step when you go towards an energy efficiency measure. And so I just want to stress these are all such simple things to do that you really, you know, you don't need the Lighting Technology Center involved. I hope you take away from this that you can really walk with these ideas and do them on your own quite simply. And with that, I think we're going to turn it back over to Len for the next speaker. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Corey. Next up is Ted Tiffany. Ted is energy management and design lecturer at Sonoma State University, and he's going to tell us about some of the work that they've done out there on the campus. He's a graduate of Sonoma State as well, and has been involved with the campus since 1994. He teaches computer-aided applications for energy management and design through the Environmental Studies Department. He also works full-time in the building performance management for Gutman and Benovit Consulting Engineers, specializing in sustainable engineering. So please join me in welcome Ted Tiffany. Thanks.
Good afternoon, and the company is Gutman and Blavatnik Consulting. Everybody murders it. So I'm going to give you a kind of an overview of what we've been doing over the last 10 years. This is a collection of studies that have been done by various entities, along with some of the students in my class for computer-aided applications in energy management and design. So, you know, we started off, you know, talking about just simplistic, fictitious examples when we started, and I quickly realized people were falling asleep in the background, and, you know, we wanted to get these kids engaged. So I talked to the facilities management guy at Sonoma State. His name's Keith Marchando, and I said, you know, what can we get involved with on campus? And he said, we've got a ton of plans. We got a ton of problems. Let's solve them together. So kind of let some of our students loose on this. So AIA credits. So we're going to learn a little bit about the Climate Action Registry and how it applies to planning our new construction project. So a little overview of the campus. So we're going to talk about a couple of the retrofit projects at the central plant, a couple of our buildings, and a couple of the new carbon liabilities we have on campus. So, you know, a couple of the retrofits we did was Darwin Hall. Retrofit was completed in 2007, and that was a Labs 21 project. The other one is Stevenson Hall that was just recently completed, going from constant volume to variable air volume and a lighting retrofit. And then the new liabilities that we've taken on here are the Recreation Center, the Salazar Hall project. I'm calling that new construction, but that is actually a renovated project. Can I get that? There's been quite a lot of activity on campus as far as expansions and retrofits and energy savings projects. It's not quite on. And we're looking at the Green Music Center as well. It's a new development of ours. The Tuscany Village is a whole student housing facility now. And the University Center is still in planning. Expected completion is 2011. So we've got a lot of stuff going on campus, and we're trying to figure out, you know, what are our new carbon liabilities for this expansion, and how is our retrofits on the other buildings applied savings to that. So what we're talking about here is carbon equivalent standards, okay? So this is the California Climate Action Registry accounting measure that is not simply CO2. It is CH4 and O2 combined to be a global warming potential, or CO2e, you'll see in here, CO2 equivalent. There are other metrics. PG&E has their own emissions rates for their distribution. Architecture 2030 has their own metrics, but today we're going to be talking about the Climate Action Registry metrics for carbon conversions. So we're talking in metric tons of CO2e equivalent per year. So this is Darwin Hall in the existing laboratory building. So this was all constant volume, quite a liability as far as energy use and energy cost in the building. And, you know, really dark building. I did a lot of my classes when I was taking classes at SSU in this building, and it was miserable. dark tinted glass, a lot of lighting power was in this building, up to 1.6 watts per square foot. No sub-metering of this building whatsoever, no building management system to know of. This was built in 1960. So this is the renovation. We wanted to look at the new programming for this space. What are the critical labs we need to deliver in this space? What are not so critical labs like geology labs and teaching labs? So we wanted to concentrate our programming first on how do we redevelop this building. So, you know, we wanted to look at energy efficiency applications, and this particular building got to 53% below Title 24 standards. And I know Paul Matthews is in the audience right now, and Title 24 is kind of a hard metric for laboratory buildings. There's a lot that Title 24 doesn't include, but this is still a great goal on or a great result for the Title 24 regulated system. So 53% better. So we went through this whole life cycle costing exercise and construction management, and the first application for this building was a variable air volume building that had a couple of steps of air change rate. So, you know, we had three different levels of air change reductions in the building that started out as a laboratory building, a classroom, and an unoccupied setback. So the unoccupied setback actually got value engineered at one point. But we knew the value of it through our life cycle cost exercises. So when we came back and we actually found funding for that to bring it down to two air changes. So essentially this is the metric we're using now with the help of Labs 21 to really look at how this building runs. You know, when the sash is open on the fume hoods, it's a laboratory building, okay? When those fume hoods are closed, it's a teaching classroom. And when it's unoccupied, we can drop down to two air changes. There's a lot of energy savings in that overnight, almost 50% of the time, dropping down to two air changes, which is still a safe by environmental health and safety concerns. So we've got occupancies installed in the lighting and the air change rate on the hoods so that we know when we've got those steps. And we actually came out with $56,000 savings a year at a first cost of $48,000. So incredible quick payback for a simple step that originally got value engineered. So for going through these value engineering phases, keep note of what has been value engineered for future projects and implementation. So now, we use an innovative technology and we're blessed with a climate that we can do this. These are what we call indirect direct evaporative cooling systems. So two-stage evaporative cooling. And in our climate, it works ideal. When our climate gets hot, it also gets dry. So we're able to use this two-stage process with very little chilled water usage, or in a couple of the buildings, actually DX component usage. So we've got a huge peak demand reduction from these air handler systems and an overall savings throughout the year of almost 90% of our chilled water. We never use it. So 90% of the time we can get away without it and still provide decent cooling for the spaces. These are integrated heat recovery systems. Okay, so every CFM of air that comes into the building is exhausted immediately. These are 100% outside air systems, and every bit of that air goes through the heat recovery system. So we're making sure we capture every bit of energy we can that's leaving the building and putting it right back in. An enormous amount of energy savings for heat recovery. So we're talking about current energy costs, and the savings potential of these systems are incredible, and we're not even considering in this slide the future impacts of energy costs, and those are ever rising. So the Darwin Hall renovation, we've actually got a 48% reduction of our carbon in this particular building. It's 677 metric tons of carbon equivalent global warming potential mitigated on this campus. It's a huge amount from this laboratory buildings, and these are the low-hanging fruit, the laboratories in our systems. They have the biggest potential for energy savings. We've got the lighting power density down to 1.1 watts per square foot. We've got integrated energy management systems and monitoring. So as we do these building performance modelings, we can now go verify them with the energy savings details coming out of the building management systems. So Stevenson Hall is our sister building to Darwin. They're right next to each other. These were a couple of the original buildings on campus. And again, this one was a constant volume, dual duct system, 1.42 watts per square foot. We call this the oil tanker on our campus. It's roughly shaped like one and uses the equivalent amount of energy. But we only have one now. Darwin Hall is running like a Coast Guard cutter, sleek, responsive, and efficient. So what we did a renovation to include variable air volume controls in the building. These are simply VAV boxes and variable speed drives on the fans at the air handler to drop that airflow and energy use quite a bit. And the lighting went from 1.4 down to 0.85 watts per square foot. So an incredible job with occupancy sensor controls. We didn't have much in the way of daylighting available from this old building. You can see there's very little windows here. But very, very efficient technologies put into the building. So this mitigated another 434 metric tons of carbon liability on the campus. So we have done a number of energy conservation projects on this campus that we've started to account for and pull all of these together over the last 10 years to figure out, you know, what did we actually save on these projects. So we did a solar thermal pool retrofit, and I didn't put this into the renewable energy category because, honestly, for pool heating, you should have solar thermal anyways. This just should have been just an automatic reduction. So we're saving 85 metric tons a year on that. The pony boiler installation was an interesting one. So we have a central plant with really old boilers. They're pretty inefficient. And the distribution loops are aging. So what they did was they planned to put at, in most of the sections of the campus, these smaller, high-efficiency, high-condensing boilers that are much more efficient than the actual central plant. And now we have individual building controls so that when one building is running on campus, we're not running the central plant and pumping hot water around the entire campus. We can actually just use the one localized boiler and burning much more high efficient. So we got a huge carbon reduction savings there, 415 metric tons. So we've done a lot in the chilled water pumping, chilled water valve and distribution retrofits on campus. We did a high efficiency chiller replacement. This is actually a constant speed chiller, but a very high efficient one that we charge our thermal energy storage tank. So we didn't really have the need for variable speed, and the cooling tower replacement. So these added to quite a bit of a mitigation for our carbon liabilities on campus. So, you know, the out with the old, in with the new kind of technologies here. So we've got standing side by side right now are the new cooling tower, the old cooling tower, and our thermal energy storage tank now. So this older redwood cooling tower is only operated in emergencies, so we're running at night our chilled water production, so we can most of the time deal without running that older cooling tower. But so it gives you an idea of the amount of savings opportunities that we've captured on this campus. So we've captured 2,300 and 16 metric tons of carbon equivalent mitigated off this campus a year. So for the life of this campus, we're not seeing that anymore. So now let's talk about our new liabilities, okay? What has been constructed on our campus while we're doing these retrofit projects? So this is our new recreation center, and this was completed in, I believe, 2003, 2004, somewhere around there. So we did a detailed building performance modeling with this, with the engineers, the architects, and really mitigated a lot of the carbon liabilities in the planning stages. So making this building as efficient as possible. So again, this building has the indirect direct evaporative cooling, has solar thermal, radiant floors for the main lobby that is in a passively shaded lobby space, so we get direct winter gains, but we mitigate a lot of the summer gains passively with that overhang right there. The lighting in this facility is outstanding. So the gymnasium lighting is actually CFLs with daylighting controls. So we have that instant on, instant off capabilities with our photocell controls. And that brought us down well below 1 watt per square foot for lighting, and that's fantastic for a building like this where the sport court lighting is a large problem in most gymnasiums. So this one actually came out 42% better than Title 24 code. This is the 2001 code. So another one of our liabilities we had to plan for. The renovated Salazar Hall, we did a lot of extensive studies on this. So we did another detailed building performance modeling on this project to figure out how we get this most efficient building we can. And, you know, new planning and staging and whatnot. So we came out with 339 metric tons of CO2 equivalent a year. And this is one we actually did a building performance prediction model, and then we matched it with the actual metered data coming off of this. And, you know, I always get the questions of, you know, building performance modeling, it's a crystal ball of predicting, you know, it's never right. Well, this one was pretty dead on. We were 7% over on the energy prediction than was actually found on campus after a year of construction. And we're trying to figure out, you know, why are we over 7%? Looking at the data, we found out, you know, we forgot about half this building is off for the summer. There's classrooms, there's a magnet high school in there. So as soon as we corrected that summer schedule, we were within 1% of prediction. Now we're still over by 1%, and there's a mass component to this building we just can't quite figure out. There's a huge high mass design that we can't account for in the tools. But this one is really efficient. Again, indirect direct evaporative systems, cooling systems. This is unique that it has a solar system on the roof that is actually sized to handle the peak air handler load. So when we go into a peak day, we're not running chilled water. The air handlers are running efficiently. We've got the solar capacity to offset the entire HVAC system. So the grid never sees that peak load of cooling. Okay? And in this climate, we can use the indirect direct evaporative cooler effectively. We had a day that was 108 degrees. No chilled water use in this building. And this is a comfort factor that is very important for this building because this building houses our president. So it was critical that we keep comfort levels in this building while maintaining an efficient application. So this is a great success for us. So humidity control, we need Keith here for this discussion. So when it's really hot, we're really dry. We're in the 5-10% relative humidity range. I mean, it's dry. It's bone dry. So we can get away with indirect direct evaporative cooler without chilled water. So this is our latest liability. The Green Music Center, okay? This is named for Don and Maureen Green. It's not meant to be a green music facility, but I'll show you by the end, it's already carbon neutral. So this is a liability. We've got this is the concert hall here. So this is one building right here that is well designed. It has underfloor air distribution. It's acoustically perfect. So this is going to be the Tanglewood of the West Coast, we'll call it. So it's a very, very nice venue. I was in this building the other day, and you can sit on the other side of the room and whisper, and you can hear it clearly. But it's gorgeous. So we got 30% better than code on this one, and a carbon footprint of 195 metric tons per year. And we do actually have an academic hall that is up and running now. So the carbon footprint there is about 213 metric tons of CO2 per year. So this is also designed very efficiently with natural ventilation strategies, operable windows, overhead fan systems, and radiant heated and cooled floors. So this is a very, very efficient design already. 0.946 watts per square foot of lighting power installed. So 27% better than Title 24. And Title 24 in this metric does not capture the radiant technologies there. So there's something missing out of that equation still that we're not credited for. So Tuscany Village is just about complete with construction. This is a village housing project that is enormous. There's 214,000 square feet, I believe 800, 750 beds, somewhere around there. Huge carbon footprint, over 1,000 metric tons a year that we need to mitigate for this project. But it's still well-designed, radiant floor systems, high-efficiency boilers, improved thermal envelope, good shading devices, thermal mass with the radiant slabs. So, you know, concentrate on effective design first to help us mitigate and get to zero with these projects. So I just added this project in because we just got the energy models back on this project to figure out what this impact is going to throw into our carbon planning. So this is a dining facility that has a lot of, I was talking to some of the food service guys here, talking about how they mitigate their carbon impacts. And food service has a large carbon impact. One, because of the ventilation. Two, because of the cooking appliances, refrigeration needs. You know, we can go on and on, but there's a big carbon liability in this building, 635 metric tons per year. But again, we can still plan for indirect direct evaporative cooler cooling, get that peak demand reduction that we want, and really design in high efficiency from the get-go. So this one's actually 43% better than current Title 24 code. We do have a couple of renewable energy productions on campus. This first one on Salazar Hall offsets about 33 metric tons of CO2 per year. And the recreation center actually has a 48-kilowatt system on top that mitigates about 10 tons a year. So now, I still have question marks in there. Sorry. We know what that is now. So I think I sent a late slide in, but hey. So these are all the projects that we need to mitigate in our planning through 2011, I think. Perhaps 2012, the University Center might be finished. But we're planning through 2012 right now for our carbon mitigation. So right now, with the energy savings projects that we've done on campus, we're accounting for 90% of that carbon CO2e emissions for the campus with our retrofits of our central plant and the two other buildings. So it was kind of sad to say after I added the University Center, I was 108% before this, and I added that in, and we went to 90%. So we still got a little bit of work to do, but I think that's a fabulous example of CO2e emissions plannings for future growth with energy efficiency projects. So, you know, what are the next steps? You know, this study only accounts for the energy use in the building. We still need to account for all the travel, commuting to and from campus, food service, things like that. But we've still got a lot of work to do on our energy modeling side. So we're going to be looking at these developments in the next round of classes, I hope, and see how we can mitigate those efforts. So the students I had in my computer modeling class this year took on these five projects that we have not yet accounted for, so are already planning to hand over to facilities a map of these additional projects to see where we can mitigate energy efficiency projects. So the project that we did at Stevenson Hall that just finished in 2009 started with a student project. They modeled the building, they did the life cycle cost analysis, and they handed that over to facilities to go get it funded. I was proud to call those students that I had in 2007 that did that project and say, hey, guess what? Your project just got completed. That CO2 emissions mitigated on the campus is responsible for you. So when you guys go back to your campuses, see how you can get your students involved. They are champions of this effort and have done an incredible amount of work on this campus to figure out where our techniques are to get to zero. And I just want to thank Keith Marchando, who's been my mentor on campus. He's retired, and you know, he always says that Bruce Walker was always his inspiration, and he lends all of his credit to Bruce. So I need to just thank these folks and thank Keith in his retirement for all the work he's done for the students and the faculty and our campus in general. So thanks.
Thank you, Ted. Next up, Robert Striff from UC Los Angeles, UCLA. Robert is currently the energy manager at UC Los Angeles, UCLA, and is one of the contributing authors of the Campus Climate Action Plan. Robert has over 17 years' experience working in the energy industry. He holds a professional engineering license from the state of California and is lead accredited professional for UCLA's public affairs building and lead existing building certification programs. Please join me in welcoming Robert.
I've been asked to give a brief talk about the energy conservation project that we're doing on the UCLA campus. It's one of our largest, in fact, it is the largest project that facilities management has attempted. It's a four-year project, and it's about a $16 million cost before utility incentives. So, before I actually talk about the energy conservation program, what I thought I would do is actually take a step back and not only are we doing the energy conservation program, but we're also doing a lot of other things on campus, and they should get a mention too. And to provide kind of that framework, I thought I would use the Climate Action Plan to show you what we're doing, and to provide a couple of slides in reference to it, and then we'll jump in and we'll get the details of the energy conservation program. So this is the graph. This is one of the summary of basically the Climate Action Plan. Basically shows the calendar years on the x-axis going up with the carbon reduction on the y. The bands of color are the projects that we're currently doing or planned. Majority of these projects are in process. The top line is the, we call it BAU, it's business as usual. This is what the campus missions would be if we did not do anything. So, and then two other targets. The 2020 target is the AB32 target. And the 2014 is the UC target. I think unlike most other campuses, our lines are actually switched. It's not a mistake. The 2020 target is actually higher. In that case, it kind of makes sense. We installed a cogeneration facility after 1990 and before 2000. So this is a little more. This is just the tabular representation of the graph. HVAC phase one is the ECP project. We just call it that because of the readers would be a little bit clearer. Actually, I just want to ask a real quick question. How many people actually have looked at the UCLA Climate Action Plan? I mean, nobody? Okay. Basically, it's a roadmap of how UCLA is going to meet the criteria they talked about before, the deadlines or AB 32 and the UC requirements. These are our planned projects. As you can see, a lot of them are in progress, and that's because of that 2014 date is the one that we really have to meet. That's what's hitting us now. So HVAC phase two, that's a continuation of the ECP project, but it's on our buildings that are more science or more medically oriented. It also shows the percentage of the total reduction that we're planning on campus. So the ECP is by far the largest reduction on campus. There's a slide. This is showing basically the cost impacts, the annual carbon reduction. And in terms of a ranking or prioritization, I've shown the factor. For the T8 replacement, that has the lowest overall. It's because we're basically retrofitting or replacing T8s that are 32 watts with T8s that are 28 watts. So that's relatively low impact. We're doing that across campus. It's a four-year project. Occupancy sensors, they're going across 37 buildings across campus. Included in that is bi-level stairway fixtures, which we pioneered with Pier. So all told, that has a factor of about $769. Other incentives are the induction lighting. We're installing induction lightings on all our parking structures. We currently have high-pressure sodiums. On-campus housing initiatives. We have three projects there. We have, an HVAC. They're going to follow us in the HVAC ECP projects. They're also going to install occupancy sensors and bi-level fixtures. They're also going to replace some of their constant volume kitchen fume hoods and make those variable volume. And that's another peer project. Solar is something that we get asked questions about all the time. The students want it. But when we look at it in terms of a factor basis, it has the worst cost per metric ton reduced. And so as such, we're going to concentrate on these other projects before we actually start doing solar. But we do have a plan to put in a quarter megawatt of solar. When we are looking at trying to develop projects to reduce our carbon emissions, one of the conventional wisdom would be start with your largest buildings. Reduce those, get your biggest bang for your buck. But what we found out, or in UCLA's case, is a lot of the buildings that are our largest user are also our most complex buildings to handle. For example, I said hospitals, medical support centers, science laboratories with outside air systems, 100% outside air systems. So these are very difficult to handle, lots of regulations, OSHPA, JCO. So we had to thought maybe there might be a better way. So our approach was that on campus, we have a lot of buildings in the 20 to 30 year age bracket. They're not sexy buildings, they're very simple buildings. They're mostly office, mixed use, classroom. They typically have constant volume double duct systems. And so that's what we decided to target them. We also had some other evidence that supported the theory that maybe those types of projects would be useful on campus. And one of the first examples of that was when we started our first MBCX project, and that was at the Factor Building. And at the Factor Building, the It was an MB6, so we're looking at a commissioning exercise when we began the process. What we started realizing right away was the mixing boxes were not functionally testing. They were failing. And so instead of going forward with the project, we had to stop, regroup, and basically do a retrofit project. In addition, when we were looking at the certifying our first pilot for LEED EB certification, that was a 50-year-old building. And the same problems followed that building as well. Initial tests did not support that we were going to be able to make the minimum energy requirement unless we did something serious to improve the ventilation systems. After going through the energy conservation process and converting those systems, we got the most points for the energy section for our LEED EB. So it does work. We also had an example of trouble calls. Trouble calls were coming in, and basically they didn't make sense. In the middle of the summer, we were getting two cold calls. Likewise, in the winter time, we were getting too hot. So this additional anecdotal evidence was suggesting that these mixing boxes were not working. We were also starting to listen to our billing operators. They kept telling us, you know, year after year, if there's a problem, there's a problem. So in the details now, switching into the ECP, high-level stuff, as I said before, it's a $60 million project before incentives. After utility incentives, we think it'll probably be $13 to $14 million. It's a four-year project. We're going to change over 180 systems, fan systems. Anticipate, is that $4 million in energy savings? It's going to occur on 26 state-funded buildings. One non-state-funded entity has participated with another one on the way. Project scope, we're going to install two weather stations. This will provide more accurate data into our building automation systems. We don't really have a centralized weather station. We rely on outside weather data for it, but we're going to do it internally. At a billing level, we're looking at the chilled water system. We're going to replace the valves, the motors, install VFD drives, and where possible, install bypasses around those pumps and just let it ride off our cogeneration supply system. And in terms of the air distribution side, the mixing boxes, this is where the bulk of the cost is going to occur. Converting those to variable volume double decks, we're adding VFDs, obviously, to the supply and return fans, CO2 sensors, controlled economizers, replace dampers, isolation dampers, and the control systems, all new controls where possible. We're also adding billing level metering. That's in support of the utility incentives we're going to be getting. In terms of the project team, because of the magnitude of this project, there's lots of people and entities involved. And as such, given our normal workload, you know, that's doubling our workload. So here's how we're organized. We have an executive oversight team. It's composed of about four or five managers, directors, overseeing the project, make sure it stays on budget. But then there's also external resource, the bulk of the mixing box change outs. Valve modifications are being handled by external sources. Internal resources are done as necessary. The bulk of the work is we're trying to do it with the external support to keep the project on track, but sometimes things just don't work out. And internal support forces will come in and handle the specialized cases. Because of the large volume of work and the ordering of materials and labor contracts, we have a significant involvement with the utility contracts. Because we're at the building, or actually at the room level, and changing mixing boxes, building coordination with the occupants is critical. Also, finally, utility provider coordination, that's to get the incentives. They need to do pre-inspections, they need to do post-inspections, there's measurement verification going on, so they're actively on campus as well. It's a typical schematic included for the engineers in the audience. Basically shows this is a standard configuration. This is also something that actually never occurs because of the variableness in the buildings and how they're constructed. This is a starting point. Oftentimes it's customized and, you know, we work from there. But what I think that the key points is it gives us a starting point. And so when we're dealing with the building operators or the zone support staff, one of the critical things is, you know, why was the reset schedules at this point? And why do we have this? And oftentimes they're not able to tell you why. So we start with the basic document and we modify as necessary. Lessons learned. often cases when we're in the building, if we had a problem with the building coordinator, let's say on a regular basis, and the energy conservation program came through, it just magnified it. If you're a pain before, you're going to be a bigger pain when you have this going through. There's a lot of people don't like to be inconvenienced. They like the idea of the program, but they don't want to have to be inconvenienced and made accommodations. Scheduling of in-house resources, we didn't give up our regular workload. Most of the work, in terms of specialized work, like I said, is going to be done in-house. But we also have regular work going on. We also have deferred maintenance. And trying to get priority over those other jobs is sometimes difficult. In terms of the advanced asbestos abatement, because of the age of the buildings, especially in the metering for the steam side, we ran into a lot of asbestos on our pipes, and that slowed the project down. Before we could actually begin work on the building, we need to have the metering installed and running, getting a baseline. That would be used to justify the utility incentives and the energy modeling. Challenges, because of the large volume of material orders, ordering BFDs, that had to be done in advance. When we first started this project last year, we didn't kind of have the wheels going. So we're getting better at that now, but it did cause significant delays in ordering. There was also a misunderstanding of who was actually going to order the material. Was it going to be UCLA in-house that was going to order the material, or was it going to be external buying material? Building manager, like I said before, and occupant coordination. Oftentimes, we'd get into a room, we would survey the situation, and find that there was something that would cause us to have to be delayed, so we'd have to come back another day. So as much as we like to put a schedule and say, we're going to come in on that date because of the variableness of the work, sometimes we were delayed, so there was continual coordination going on. In-house resources versus contractor support. Like I said, because we didn't necessarily know what was happening until we actually started getting up into the ceilings and looking at the actual configuration of the ducts, it was impossible to say if we could do this with in-house or external support. So oftentimes it caused delays in terms of who's actually going to work, which also caused the contractors to not trust the schedule. So they would go ahead and reallocate their resources until we could figure out what we needed to do. In conclusion, really quickly, this is a picture of my kids. We went to the beach a couple days ago, and they wanted to know what I was doing, and they wanted to participate, and they wanted their names and lights. And I said, well, I don't think so. This is kind of a technical presentation. But after thinking about it, you know, a lot of the things that we do, we don't necessarily get credit for. And in the past, most of the decisions were based on, well, you know, did it save money? Did you extend the life of the equipment beyond its normal useful life? We go ahead and replace it. But the stuff that we're doing now, these conferences, we're doing it for them. We're saving, we're making a better environment, we're making it more sustainable. So they just wanted to say thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.